It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists with your host, Jill Dittmeyer, a journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. The call-in phone number is 317-788-3314. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
Hello, I'm Jill Dittmeyer, a curious journalist and arts enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations.
And we're doing that today. In fact, we are on Zoom because it's July of 2020 and we still can't get back into our studios, but we're still having a wonderful conversation. And today we're going to be talking about the art and science of collecting. And our guests are familiar voices here to the Da Vinci Pursuit Conversations. Mark, why don't you introduce our guests and let us know a little bit more about our topic today.
Well, we're so pleased to have Dr. Shirley Mueller, who's a neuropsychologist and author. Hi, Shirley.
Hi, Shirley.
See you, Mark. Nice to see you.
And Robin Toulouse, who's an artist, but also from my past, a former person in the collections of the Children's Museum.
Hey, Mark.
Robin. And so we're going to be talking about the important role of collecting, conservation, display of objects. But I think it's particularly pertinent because people are at home and they may want to think about collecting things and or starting a collection. It's a good opportunity to do that.
Or maybe getting rid of things that they've been collecting and finding a better way to use them.
that's we'll leave that up to Robin to tell how you can successfully deaccession an object in your home. Shirley, particularly, you have a book that I love. And it's the Inside the Head of a Collector, the Neuropsychological Forces at Play. And you collect porcelain. And you even actually do speaking engagements. More about that?
Yes, and I missed about six of them due to COVID, which is so sad because the book came out in August of 2019, and obviously speaking engagements is a good way to promote a book. And I miss speaking not only here in Indianapolis, but also on the East Coast and in London. But hopefully they'll all resurface the opportunities.
They will.
So you're kind of our expert in collecting and as to why. Why do we collect, Shirley?
Well, 40% of the population collect. And part of the reason that we collect is because it gives us pleasure. That's really the primary reason, in my opinion. Although there have been varying views in the past. One of the views by Münsterberger was that we collected because we were depraved or deprived in childhood. Mm. Now, few collectors would like that theory, but we had to live with that since 1994 until my book was written, which puts a positive spin on collecting. You know, even Freud, said that collectors are people who are simply sublimating their libido by collecting objects.
That would be Freud.
That would be Freud. And you know what? Freud collected. He collected Greek objects.
And Shirley, I don't know how anybody could think that the idea of something being that you didn't have in your childhood, because I know very young children who start collecting.
Exactly.
And so it's kind of like one of those, well, what was that guy who wrote that in 1995 thinking? Has he ever observed kids? Because collection, isn't that true, Robin? Does collecting start very young for some people?
I collected those plastic horses. They always talk about girls and plastic horses, and I was definitely one of those. So I understand that from a very young age, I was collecting those horses.
Plastic horses, I love that.
Yeah.
You probably would have preferred to collect real horses, I would think.
Surely, so if it's not about our childhood, well, I mean, it has something to do with collecting. But I think a lot of people, you know, their fear is, am I a collector or a hoarder? Are they the same things? Are they not? And now, since people have spent a lot of time back in their homes again, they're probably really asking themselves that question.
Well, fortunately, most collectors are not hoarders. Only 3 to 6% of people who collect are hoarders. And the major difference between the two is that collectors enjoy their collection and hoarders do not. For hoarders, the collection causes a great deal of stress because it affects their family life. Their family doesn't want everything that they collect. It affects even their association with other people because they can't invite them to their house. They can't have social obligations returned. And what hoarders tend to collect is of little value, like string, dirty coins from the street, that sort of thing. So collectors and hoarders are very different. One seeks pleasure and the other has a compulsion, a kind of obsessive compulsion to collect anything.
Surely, and I think you just said it, the anything, doesn't that also help separate it? That collectors typically have certain things that they want to get. Yeah. And somebody who's a hoarder, it really is just the act of collecting something, anything.
Right. They collect many more things, where collectors tend to be specific. And they may collect something that's interrelated, like different types of furniture, but they still will be collecting in an area. So they look and look for that special piece that they want. And people have written about tension of collectors, that collectors, when they set a goal, they feel tension in their body until they actually achieve that goal, which is often getting several pieces or many pieces that they're looking for. And when they buy that piece, it relieves the tension.
Interesting. Robin, your art is kind of can be a cross between collecting and the hoarding thing. Not that you're a hoarder, but you look for unique things to put together to create your art. Tell people a little bit more about the art that you create.
Well, I'm an assemblage artist. And so what I've been doing for years now is going to thrift shops, going on eBay, finding things in the street. I found a dead bird once and it had recently died, but I wanted to bring it home and let it, let the skin and feathers fall away. And then I could use a skeleton and a piece of art. So I'm always looking for quirky things to put into my assemblage boxes.
As Shirley mentioned, that collectors usually go after, you know, a certain thing, and there's that tension to find that thing. Do you have that same feeling when you're creating a piece of art? Do you have in your mind, these are the items I want to collect or find to finish this piece?
Yes. I definitely do. Well, I will scour the earth until I find what I want to finish an assemblage. If I've got an idea and I really feel the need to do that, I will search eBay. I will go out to thrift shops and antique shops until I find what I want.
That's interesting. And then that makes me ask you, Shirley, where do most people collect? I'm guessing everywhere and anywhere.
Absolutely. People collect where their finances would allow them to collect. People who are wealthy will go to high-end dealers, at least to start the process. They'll go to fairs, either locally or on the coast. They'll go to auctions similarly, either locally or on the coast. And many people actually go abroad to collect, because a collector goes where his or her objects are located. For example, I like to collect in the Netherlands because they were one of the first importers of Chinese export porcelain, which is what I collect. And so for example, in Holland right now and in Belgium, they have so many beautiful, old, unique pieces that it just makes my heart happy and my mind glow with pleasure when I see them up for auction, for example.
So you get that tension thing, huh?
Well, and yes. In fact, it happened just recently. I wanted to buy a piece at an auction abroad. This one was in Portugal. And I consulted several people about it, and the provenance was good. It went back for 20, 30 years. I felt comfortable about the piece. But in the end, I thought, if I buy it, I just have to deaccess it. So I decided to let it go. Because it's collecting, then care and maintenance, and then deaccession. And because of my age, I'm more in the deaccession stage, although occasionally I still have to buy something.
And with Robin, with your art, how is assemblage different than like shadow boxing or that kind of thing, like creating memorials to something, or is it similar?
It's similar, I'd say. It's pretty similar. My work is actually inspired by a Victorian memorial, shadow boxes and photographs. That's my greatest inspiration. And so I see a similarity, but I think a lot of shadow boxes are just showcasing objects and not trying to tell a story. And I'm always trying to tell a story with my art.
And then Shirley, with your porcelain collection, are you trying to tell a story with your collection?
Absolutely. I started out with teapots. I must have about 300 teapots, and I wanted to tell the history of Chinese export teapots throughout time. And I actually did that in 5 papers. I have more papers on Chinese export teapots, published papers, than anybody in the world. So I became a little obsessed, like a...
You have a collection of papers about a collection of your collection.
Exactly. But it served me well that I was invited to speak multiple places, including in China. So the Chinese are collecting, are bringing back what they originally exported. So they want to know from Americans and Europeans and others who purchased from them long ago what we know about what they're now collecting back again.
That's what I wondered too, for both of you. And for Shirley, when someone invites you to speak about collecting, what is it that they want to know? Is there something specific about the topic, or is it specific about, is my brain okay that I'm a collector? Or there's so many different things.
Well, it's dependent. If it's about teapots, they want to know about teapots. But if it's about collecting, they really want to know something about themselves. And as a collector, just like my audience, when I speak about collecting, I feel that we just start out right on the same wavelength. And that my journey was to understand why I did the things I did when I collected, many of which were irrational. And so in my book, I try to explain why my irrational behavior, and people in the audience often identify with it. They say the same thing has happened to me.
And Robin, I'm wondering about that with your art. Do you create your art for yourself, or do you create it thinking that someone else might be sharing this feeling or this memory and want to purchase that and have in their home? Or,
well, yeah, initially I really did make the art for myself, and then a mutual friend of ours, Rita Kahn, told me I should be showing my work, and so I did for several years show my work at the Art Bank and then at Full Circle 9 Gallery. And I found that very surprisingly and happily, people really did want to know about my work. They felt a connection, and they felt the emotions that I was conveying. And then I was so happy to be able to share my work with those friends and those people who collected my work. So, yeah.
Robin, what are you currently working on?
I just finished an art and seek project for the Art Council of Indianapolis and Keep Indianapolis Beautiful. It's a public art project that starts officially on August 1st and goes through the 1st of 2021. And my particular work, I don't know, Mark, if you know about my Curiously Tiny People pieces.
Yes.
I use Altoid tins. And I put a background in the back of the tin, and then I populate the tins with people. So I tell stories in these small tins. Usually I'll use a museum, or I'll use a neighborhood, and I'll put people in them doing things. This particular project, though, is in my own neighborhood of Emerson Heights on the near east side of Indianapolis. I've used homes in Irvington and landmarks around the area, and I put people in them of the neighborhood and on the little free libraries in the neighborhood, so that over the next few months, people will be able to come around and look for them.
I actually saw a picture that you had on the internet, Robin.
Uh-huh.
It looked like the brick filler, like you're discussing.
Yes.
I thought it looked fabulous.
And it reminded me
of Banksy in a way. I mean, you're doing this, you know, people have to look for. And
so
yours,
Robin,
is actually better than Banksy, I thought.
So Robin, help me understand. You mean, you were actually, while you're walking along, you discover these little Altoid tins in different locations?
Well, what's going to happen is the Arts Council and Keep Indianapolis Beautiful are going to put out a computer program so that people will be able to go around Indianapolis and find the art. It's in neighborhoods that have been not underserved by art over the years. And so that's why my neighborhood is one of them. I think Little Flower, which is also near here, is one of the neighborhoods that's going to be showcased. But all over Indianapolis are going to be these works of art by Indianapolis artists.
It's a wonderful project from the Arts Council, and it was something that they've been doing and they had already planned. And it's even better timing with the pandemic, because it's a safe way for people to get out and explore their neighborhoods and see art. And I know that some artists have already started putting up their art that were selected to be part of this program. In fact, I know Philip Campbell has created it looks like a grapevine fencing like thing, but on it he has hung masks. So people who need a mask can go there and get one. Or if somebody is making masks, they can donate their mask and put it on there too. So he really adapted his Art and Seek project to literally fitting for the time and the moment. Is like I said, we're taping this in July of 2020, so it's perfect timing for it.
Jill, is that a bandana that you're wearing, or is it a mask?
It's a bandana, and since we've got radio listeners, since we're Zoom taping this, so we can all see each other, so because we're trying to recreate the feel of being in the studio, so we can all kind of see each other here as we tape too, so we're all kind of in our own weird little places with our own things. And this is a great example, though, Shirley, as you point this out. What I've been using regular masks, but I've also been using, these were scarves that belonged to my dogs. That when I used to have dogs, I used to get scarves for them. And actually my mother was very much, I guess you could call her, a collector of scarves. And she would find these scarves and she would get them and give them to me. Because as I was thinking about when you were talking about, Shirley, that everybody collects something, I was trying to think if I really collect anything. And I don't really think I do. I feel like I get people that give me, like they think it's something that I want or I need. And then they just start like collecting it for me.
Yeah, what's the psychology of someone collecting for someone else?
Yeah.
Gosh, I would say not healthy.
I think with my mother, she was trying to do it as like the role of the grandmother, the grandmom to the grand dogs or something.
Right.
I don't know. But yeah, do talk about that, Shirley, because that is kind of an interesting thing.
Well, these bandanas now have sentimental meaning to you, Jill, so you keep them and wear them and enjoy them. I've not thought about this subject before, but it would seem to me that someone, if a person collects for another person, that person is imposing their own wishes on someone else. And that's why I would think it would be unhealthy normally, except perhaps in a mother-daughter, father-son relationship. You know, what son wouldn't like to get a Patek Philippe watch from his father?
Yeah, sign me up for that, Dad, too. Yeah. We are talking about collecting all things normal and maybe not so normal with Dr. Shirley Mueller. She's a neuropsychologist and author of the book Inside the Head of a Collector. And with Robin Toulouse, our Emerson Heights artist, who is telling us about her Art and Seek project, one of the many assemblage pieces that she creates. We're going to take a short break and then we will be back with more conversation.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope, furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Rock and roll has evolved over the years from a sound that shaped the youth of a nation.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl. You're crying all the time.
To an era that started a rebellion.
We're the rebel, yeah. She cried more, more, more.
Or even bringing in a brand new generation. Every week on After Dark, we look through the songs and the stories that shape rock and roll as we know it today.
After Dark, Sundays at 1 a.m. on 88.7 WICR.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee. Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
And welcome back. I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling. And today we're talking about the art and science of collecting with Dr. Shirley Mueller and Robin Toulouse. When we left after our first little segment, Shirley, I'm curious. You say it makes people happy to collect. Does it actually light up parts of the brain, like with endorphins, or does it affect our hormones in some way?
Absolutely. You know, the nucleus accumbens just is our pleasure center. And yes, when we see something that we like that fits our criteria for our collection, it burns brightly. And the most interesting thing about this is that lighting up. When we want something and when we seek it is much more vivid than when we actually obtain what we want, which means that that's why we're always hunting. We're always looking for the next best thing. So as soon as we buy something, we're done. Then we need to go and look for something else.
So when you talk about, Shirley, some of our listeners may not know, when you talk about lighting up, you're talking about imaging the brain.
Yes, I am.
During something.
Resonance imaging, okay. Which depends on oxygenation. Now, think about when we use our muscles, when we exercise, oxygen increases to our muscle. Well, the same thing happens in our brain when we're using different parts of the brain. And so when we see what we want, more oxygen goes to our pleasure center because it's requiring more oxygen, and that can be determined with very sophisticated magnetic imaging, which has only been available since the early 1990s. So we could only do these studies and find out what we know today since that time, which is why psychiatrists and psychoanalysts and so on in the past were in the dark. They could really only make theories. They didn't really have scientific instruments to support their theories. So we're very fortunate today. We're making great progress.
So where is the line between collection for pleasure and delighting that up and addiction to the feeling as opposed to the feeling of pleasure as opposed to the feeling of obtaining that object?
They're very much along the same lines. Addiction to a substance does light up the same area of the brain. Endorphins are released, as you suggested, Mark. And it's the difference is person specific. For example, most people do not have a need for dependency on drugs, but those that do seem to have some kind of genetic predisposition. For collecting, which is socially acceptable and obviously a better route to go, people are born with a genetic predisposition, their environment feeds into it, and then their experiences. And the experience can be something as simple as having a teacher whom they admire, who collects, let's say, Japanese netsukis. And that just leads them into that particular area of collecting because they admire their teacher and then they get interested in what the teacher's interested in.
Robin, when it comes to your art, I know you've done other methods and mediums of art too. What led you to the assemblage work?
Well, there are a couple of things that happened. A friend of mine who is a curator actually at the Children's Museum brought a book into the museum one day to show everybody. Her field of interest was Victorian memorial practices, and she brought a book in called Sleeping Beauty. And it was memorial photographs of people who had died. And during the Victorian period, a lot of times the only photographs that people could get were post-mortem. Mm-hmm. And that book, it really did a number on me. I was actually obsessed about it for a long time and a little physically sick from it, from being exposed to it and what it did to me. But it got me over my fear of death, I'll tell you that. And it made me sick too. I became sick with pleurisy during that whole time. I was so intensely obsessed with that book that I became very sick. And I was reading a book about Käthe Kollwitz, the German artist. She was mostly a printmaker. And all of a sudden, I just got up in the middle of the night and I knew I had to make a memorial piece. And I did. I got up sick as a dog in the middle of the night to make my first assemblage. And that just set me on the course to continue to make these pieces that were really, they were memorials for all kinds of things, not just for death, but for things that had passed.
So that, was it more cathartic for you at that point then? Or were you thinking, I'm gonna make this and sell this piece?
Oh, cathartic. It was cathartic and it was a creative release. I had no intention. That piece is still in my collection. I will never sell that piece. It's far too important to me.
So this goes back to some things that we've done on a couple of other shows where we talk about art therapy and
the
arts as a therapy. And in fact, Robin, what you're talking about is that you went into doing this more as a therapy for yourself as well as a creative release, but certainly not to be an artist selling that.
Correct. That's absolutely right. I had no intention of selling the art I initially began making when I started making assemblages.
Do you still have that same intensity and that same feeling when you're creating, like you're creating these adorable little mini things that people are taking already and they shouldn't be taking them, but...
No, I don't. These things are a lot of fun, and I enjoy making them a lot. And they're a challenge, but I'm not as emotionally involved with them. They're meant to be fun. And so they're not like my serious assemblage pieces.
Which surely then as a collector, are we getting into dangerous territory when it's not fun to collect anymore? When it becomes more of that kind of obsessive thing, or we're just doing it to do it? Or does that even happen with collecting? Or do real collectors, once the fun is done, they move on to a different item? Or
they can move on to a different item. The fun can abate when a collector becomes a dealer. And that's a whole nother area. Collecting is fun. And every collector will sell a few pieces here and there. That's fine. And they will collect primarily so they can buy something better. Some collectors, however, will begin to sell parts of their collection themselves. And then they find that it's so much more satisfying to buy than to sell. And especially if you sell it yourself. It's hard work. Because what you love, not everyone else is going to love. And collectors always think what they have, what they own, is worth more than it really is. Just like if we buy a cup, we even think that cup is worth more than someone else will. That was a cup study. There was actually a study with cups.
That's interesting. Shirley, do you think I've heard this before, you know, that collectors think that they overvalue what they have. Do you think that people use it as a rationale, like they have a really great coin collection and they go, this is going to be for my, you know, children and grandchildren, and it's going to be there, that it's more not a reality, but a rationalization of that they just like doing the collecting the coins.
And the hope that their children and grandchildren will like it. And there's just no harm in that, really. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's wonderful to have hope, I think, and to think you're doing something for the next generation, whether you are or not. Many collectors collect because they like history and they're putting something together that they think will be important in the future, either for a museum or for their family, any number of things. And in a way, it's seeking mortality, which is okay too, because many people do hate to face their death. And so if they think that they can live on through their objects, what's the harm?
Well, and that's exactly what Robin's doing with the art.
Yes.
Yeah, and from both of you, isn't there a social aspect also among collectors?
That's the best part. You know, just all the people that I have met and enjoyed, and even in the last couple of days, my emails have been primarily with people who are collectors or curators or speakers about Chinese porcelain. We all have this common interest. And it is truly, I think, one of the most important areas. That for me, the education and the social are the two most important.
And Robin, I know for artists, it can be that way as well, which is why, you know, for many years you had your work in galleries. So was that, it had to have been inspiring to you to be able to share the stories behind your art? I mean, that's what I always love to hear. Where did you find this? Why is this? And what is this about? What does it mean to you? Is that, what part of being an artist is having your work in front of people to be able to, for them to get something from it?
It's really important. And for the years that I was doing it, first Fridays were always so exciting. My adrenaline would be rushing and I would be getting all gussied up to go to the gallery and hang out with people and the other artists. We would all be bouncing our ideas off of each other. And then we would just have the pleasure of watching people come through the gallery and admiring our work and talking about it with us. There was nothing as exciting, though, obviously, as having someone walk up and show real love for something that I had made and that they had connected with it. And when they purchased it, well, that was just the icing on the cake. It was always wonderful.
And now that you're kind of working out of your home, do you miss that gallery interaction, or are you just finding other ways to get that? Or are you at a point with your art that it's really okay without that?
Right now it's really, well, obvious, because we're all pretty much forced to social distance. So nobody's doing anything. Most of the gallery exhibits right now are virtual. And so people can see work online, but my work doesn't translate very well to online because it is three-dimensional. So right now I'm focusing more on doing things at home and creating beautiful spaces here until things open up again.
And for a collector, Shirley, how important is it for a collector to actually see and hold that item in person? Or does that have any effect at all on the what lights up in the brain and what doesn't? And
I think it's very important. But the recent sale at Sotheby's would suggest that that isn't as important as I thought, because they had a record sale without the buyers seeing their pieces ahead of time, because it was all virtual. So I feel like, I'm just surprised that people will buy art they don't see. On the other hand, I was going to do that with the sale in Portugal, which is why I got the provenance of it, which made me feel comfortable. And I had other opinions too on it.
But so explain the provenance for our listeners that aren't aware what that is.
That's the history of the piece, who's owned the piece. With a particular kind of porcelain that I buy, it has been primarily faked since maybe the early 2000s. Before that, it was less faked. And so I feel comfortable if a piece has a good lineage, has been owned by specific people in the last 30 or 40 years. I think it makes me think it's good. There's so much faking that it's really hard to tell what is fake and what is not these days with Chinese porcelain. More than 50% of it is faked, and in China, it's even higher because most of the fakes come from China.
So someone who is a collector, that's probably a very important part of the education of becoming a collector then, is to learn how you're buying the real thing and you're not buying a fake item. Or if you do buy a fake item, it doesn't upset you so much that maybe it throws you off your collecting.
So it's really, don't you think, Shirley, it also goes to a financial thing?
Yeah.
Absolutely. If it's fake, it's worth nothing.
Right. And so you may have paid a lot. So you've got a double whammy. Not only is it not what you thought you collected, but you paid a lot for it. And now you've got that loss of that I made a mistake. Oh, I feel... you know, that I'm an idiot kind of inside, and your self-esteem, you know, you do.
There were, confirming what you say, Mark, there were pieces that were faked in the late 70s, early 80s, and it was the George Washington service, the Order of Cincinnati service that actually belonged to George Washington. And there were blank pieces, but they had the rim like the George Washington service that were sold in London. And some dealer purchased them and had them repainted in the center to look like the authentic as much as possible. People who bought these pieces won't give them up today because they don't want people to know they purchased them. For example, I know a curator who knows some people who had some, and I wanted to borrow one to compare to my authentic, and the person wouldn't sell it because they were so ashamed of buying it. Ashamed is the wrong word, it's too strong, but they were so upset, I guess.
Well, but, and that's what, when you said that, ashamed or upset about it, is that the difference between collecting for something specific as opposed to, like, when you purchase art? Like, art, if you see something and you love it, you really, sometimes you don't care whether it's the real thing or the fake thing.
If it's only for decorative purposes, yes.
Yeah.
But if it's to be part of of your collection that tells a story, then it's not just for decorative purposes, it becomes sacred to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I imagine, Shirley, that some people jump from maybe it was just to have that piece, but then they like it so much, or they like what the artist is producing, and they kind of slip into being a collector.
Yes.
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 Do you have collectors of your art, Robin?
Yes, I do. I have a few who routinely purchase pieces, and that's wonderful.
And what is it, what do they tell you about that?
They just tell me that my work speaks to them, that they love what I do, and they like me as a person as well. I think that the personal relationship, as well as the art, is really important to collectors, that they feel it's important to know who the artist is and what she is and where she comes from and what made her do these things. And I've become friends with actually a woman out in Sacramento who's also an artist, and she's a collector of mine now. And another woman who lives in St. Paul, Minnesota. They've both become good Facebook friends of mine. And so, and we share the same political leanings, and so it's a great pleasure to be able to talk to them. And when they buy something of mine, it's just really nice.
I love that. That social aspect is really, really important. Well, we're talking about the art, the science, and the socialization of collecting today with Robin Toulouse and Dr. Shirley Mueller. And we're going to take a short break, but before we do, we want to remind you that this program is made possible by the generosity of an anonymous donor who supports the Da Vinci Pursuit's mission, which is to create a museum without walls so that artists, scientists, and you, the community, can all come together for unique activities and conversations. And we'll continue ours in just a minute.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR The Diamond.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
Hey everybody, I'm Joe Girard, your host for Inside Great American Music. And as you know by now, we're here every Sunday at 5 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Diamond, 88.7 WICR. You also know our show revolves around the great American songbook. And this week I'm being a little bit selfish as I present my favorite male singers. It's Tony, Nat, Frank, and Vic, right here on 88.7 The Diamond WICR. Join us 5 p.m. Eastern this Sunday.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and we've been talking about collecting and inside the head of a collector with Robin Toulouse, an Irvington-based artist, and Dr. Shirley Mueller, who's a neuropsychologist and an author as well. And, you know, Robin, my past intersected with yours at a time that you were managing the collection at the Children's Museum, and yeah. I wondered, I think one of the dangers that a collector could get into who's not a hoarder would be, if you get into it too much, would being able to find what you have. Are you have any wisdom as a collections manager as to what people should be doing so that they don't overfill without knowing where things are?
Oh my gosh, to be able to inventory things, you mean, and keep track of where they are?
Yeah, I mean, if you're collecting some big pieces like vases or something, I don't think you get overwhelmed. But if you were collecting smaller things like you are, you're going to use and stuff, I could imagine that it'll get buried and you won't remember that there's something there.
Yeah, just like Shirley was talking about collecting Nexkies. Those are very small. You might be in trouble. So it is probably good for collectors, amateur collectors, to keep an inventory of what they've got so that they can, and that's good for insurance purposes for sure. Because if you've got a collection that is worthy of safekeeping, you should probably have it insured. And in that case, inventory is very important. And I inventoried all the works that are on the pillars here in the neighborhood. I know where each one is, and if I have to repair or replace one of them, I can do it very easily. So if a person did that with their own home collection, that would be a very good idea, I think.
Shirley, for the upkeep of something, to keep its value, or is there something that we should be doing as collectors, or do we just try to keep it as close to the original as it was when you purchased it?
Well, the insurance companies do want to increase the value every year, of course, since the likelihood of damage, fire, complete destruction is low, I choose not to do that. I do have an inventory with pictures and so on. I use Collector Pro, and I just got from someone at the Frick in New York two other programs to use that they would recommend. And actually, I'd love to know what the Children's Museum uses, because collection inventory is so important. I have about 600 pieces. So I have actually at times lost my pieces in the house. And I have had to go and look for them. But now in my inventory, the location is also in the stats. So I can find where it is.
So when I was at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago years ago, they had collected so many things like cars, automobiles from all different eras that never saw the light of day in the collections. But they had so much room down below that you just kept collecting them. And nobody knew what there was down there. Mm-hmm. They're probably, Robin, were on little pieces of paper in an inventory system, but nobody actually knew until somebody went down and walked through and they go, oh my gosh, we have all these. What are we doing with these?
Oh my gosh.
So do you think institutions can also be hoarders?
Oh, yes. Some curators tend toward the hoarding gene. And yes, we had a lot of things in the collection that were probably not of a quality that should have been at the Children's Museum or have been displayed at the museum. And that's when deaccessioning comes in. And it's a very important part of collecting, to be able to look at your collection and pick the pieces that don't really fit with your mission or are not of a quality or don't have the context of the provenance, as Shirley was talking about, so that you can't tell the stories of those objects, it's a good time to deaccession those. Maybe send them to another museum. If they're not of a quality, to go to another museum, possibly auctioning them off for sale.
So Shirley, I would think that the psychology there is of the donor who gave it, thinking it probably would be in perpetuity. Is a really interesting, tricky thing.
The donor signs a piece of paper, and of course, in current times, the paper generally will not say it's in perpetuity. So that means that the museum can do what it sees fit. Usually, I think the museum tries to wait until the donor dies, if it is a large donor to the institution, but then informs the family, or hopefully informs the family before deaccessioning it. Our own museum, Newfields, is labeling objects A, B, and C. So it is actually actively at the present time trying to deaccess the lower end objects to make room for others and also to decrease the cost for the storage, which is enormous.
Yeah, you brought up something really important, which is the science of conserving. And what people don't realize, why shouldn't I just build another building to house it? But we're talking about temperature control, humidity control, talking about insects. I mean, there's so many things that go to maintaining a collection bigger than you really need that I don't think people understand that you can't just keep adding. At some point, you have to also remove.
Right. And it's rather a new thing that museums are so sensitive about this and so attuned. I think maybe 20, 30 years ago, museums just didn't deaccess like they do now. Mm-hmm. I can remember going in one museum, this was maybe 20 years ago, and we were a small group and we were showing a piece in stores, and someone said, well, who gave this to the museum? And the curator said, we really don't know. We don't have any record. But that's happening much less too, obviously.
Right.
Is there such thing as a collector of pieces that museums don't want to collect anymore?
Yes.
I mean, yeah. What do museums do when they want to get rid of pieces like that?
Well, they send them to auction. Or, as Robin said, they give them to another museum that might want them. Maybe a museum that specializes in that area. At Newfields, we just gave a lot of drawings to another museum, and the other museum had better pieces of art by that artist, and we had preliminary drawings in our collection.
So it continued their story for them.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And like with your objects, you have been able to present them for people too. So like you said, you have many in your home, so they bring you pleasure on a daily basis, but you also share your collection with other people, which is extraordinary, because I got to see your collection at Newfields and it was divine.
Well, I feel very fortunate in that way, because not everyone has that opportunity. And so there's a video, as you know, about the last exhibit, and the one before that, there's also a video. The only one that doesn't have a permanent record is my first exhibit, but that's all right.
And Robin, as an artist, you archive your shows as well.
That's right. We live in a small house in Emerson Heights, and I am a very prolific artist. And so I have a large inventory of art in this house. And unfortunately, I don't have a very good tracking of that inventory in this house right now. But yes, I definitely have archived all of the existing art that I have in my possession still.
And I think once again, that's the beauty of art and collecting both, is that you get something out of it, that you don't tuck it away or hide it away, that you display it, whether it's just for yourself or hopefully for other people too. Mm-hmm. That it's not maybe just something that maybe becomes an obsession of, I got to buy this and have this, and then I'm going to write it down and keep it in this box and never take it out again. To me, that seems like that might be a problem, but I don't know.
Sounds like we're also in an exciting time, Shirley and Robin, because we can actually, through science, know some things, like Shirley, what you were talking about.
Yeah.
The IMA, and you know, Newfields and the IMA have a forensics lab that can actually analyze whether something is a forgery. Mm-hmm. And we know that people do have feelings that are positive, and that collecting can be a positive part of their lives, mm-hmm. because we know what happens in the brain. So,
right.
So the science is definitely also interwoven with all this.
Oh, yeah.
Well, collecting, for most people, collecting is a passion. And I think we're so lucky if we have passion in our lives. Whether it's passion for another person or for a particular area of collecting or for creating art or for cats, whatever it is, I mean, it enriches our lives and makes life worth living.
It's great.
It does. I just have a very short little amount of time left. Robin, do you collect anything specifically?
Oh my gosh, I have several collections. A lot of the things I collected over the years were purchased at the Children's Museum gift shop. We had, when the Kaplan collection back in 1984, the gift shop outside of that collection had anthropological objects that were for sale to the general public. And I purchased many of those because I fell in love with the world cultures when I was at the museum. And so I have Indonesian shadow puppets and a round box from Papua New Guinea and a gaba hanging in our bedroom. So I have a lot of anthropological collections from that time in my life. And I collect plants now. I have a lot of plants.
I love it. Well, we appreciate both of you sharing your stories about your collecting and your passions for your collecting, which is art and vice versa. Thank you to Shirley Mueller, the author of Inside the Head of a Collector, and to Robin Toulouse. Look for her Art and Seek project out there really soon.
And you'll find pictures of their projects and those of other guests on our website, thedaVinciPursuit.com. where we create museums without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
And until next time, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to
stay curious.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on thedaVinciPursuit.com. Or you could join Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling every Saturday live on a different kind of public radio, 88.7 WICR.